Exactly 11:30. Our next guest has been at various times in his career a copywriter, a jingle maker, a songwriter, a record producer, an action thriller writer, but is best known as a legendary radio DJ. Power Play.
Girls, whatever you wear, your face is still there. You won't help your spots by hiding them from people. You might lose a few friends, but you won't lose any spots. But what can you do about it?
What can we do about it, Mark?
That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Oh, how many spots have you lost today, love?
Thought you might like that.
Good grief. Where did you find that lot?
Oh, God knows. Mark Wesley, welcome to Let's Talk. It's a pleasure to have you on, sir.
Thanks for inviting me. That's absolutely brilliant. And it's so great to be somewhere warm.
Yeah, we're very warm here at the moment. So yeah, absolutely. You're back in the sunny UK, aren't you, at the moment? Yeah.
Yes, I'm sitting under cloudy skies, I'm afraid. We had one nice day yesterday, took the grandchild to Clacton. Oh, we know all the good places. And we came back to this rather overcast sky, and it's a bit disappointing.
Oh, bless you. Now, let's, if we can, start back at the very beginning with you. Firstly, your very confusing name, because you appear to have had three names, as far as I can work out. There may be more.
You've got to keep going. They can't find you if you keep changing your name.
Martin Wesley Cole, Your Honour, was your first name.
Well, no, it's actually Goebel is my family name, G-O-B-L-E.
So there's four names.
I know, I don't know where this Cole business comes from. I have no idea what that is. It's somebody else.
Oh, brilliant. We go back to the pirate days, and I certainly were one of the people who would sit under the covers. And in fact, I'm pretty sure I built a crystal radio when I was a kid. I think a lot of people did, and they kind of hide under the covers and try and tune in the pirate radio stations. I was lucky enough to go into broadcasting, like yourself, back in the good old days in 1975, when commercial radio launched in the UK. But before that, you were on the pirate stations. What was your path? I believe you were a record plugger, weren't you?
I in between radio in the early days, in order to keep in touch with the radio stations, and there was a choice of two, effectively. You had Radio 1, of course, BBC Radio 2 as well, and Radio Luxembourg.
Yeah.
So in between having worked on... Well, in the early days, in the 60s, of course, 1965, when I started on Radio Essex, when that all closed down because of the government regulations, the Marine Offences Act, then I went into record plugging, because it wasn't such a thing as Radio 1, Radio 2 then. It was just the light program, home service, whatever it was. So I was plugging records for Acuff Rose, and then I had a call from Roger Day a few years later to join Radio Naughty International. He said, "Do you fancy getting back on radio?" I said, "Not half." And he said, "Meet me at Gatwick." So,
wow. You were plugging records for Acuff Rose, the legendary publisher who were responsible for Hank Williams' career, amongst others.
And Gentle on My Mind and stuff like that. Wow. So it's a very interesting time. So, it's a confused career, because I worked on Radio Essex, then I worked on Radio 270, and then I worked on Radio Scotland, and it was at Radio Scotland when the Marine Offences Act came in, so it was pretty late in the day by the time I ended up taking this record plugging business.
Yeah.
But it kept me close, you know, to the business, and I needed to do that in order to have any hope of, you know, getting back into it.
Were they all physical ships at that point?
Radio Essex was a fort, an old naval fort, 12 miles off of Foulness Island in the Thames. And I conjured the strap line, Radio Essex, the voice of Essex, from the mouth of the River Thames.
Love it. And what about the other two, Radio 270 and Radio Scotland?
They were ships.
Yeah.
They were small ships, small vessels, moored in the North Sea. And, you know, whereas down south the sea is you know, off of Clacton around that way, it's actually quite shallow.
Yeah.
So you get these short seas, and you know, it doesn't really rock the way deep oceans rock.
You're right.
And I can testify to the amount of rocking. And this wasn't radio. This wasn't rocking radio. This is a rocking ship.
Wow.
And I struggled with the you know, seasickness and stuff like that.
I bet. Yeah. And of course, people who weren't there to witness it or weren't around at the time will have watched the movie, The Boat That Rocked, and kind of that kind of sold what it really was like, I guess.
Yes, in a kind of a kind of a hodgepodge gathering together of stuff, you know, from anecdotes and bits and pieces. They've all been thrown together to form one ship. But, you know, for people who had actually worked on the pirate ship, it didn't represent anything that we really recognized as reality.
Mm.
One of the things that very often defined your life on the ship was the proximity of the coast. It seemed quite close on a clear night.
Yeah.
You didn't get any of that sense of its proximity. Also, the vessels seemed to have a different type of antenna. The ships had very tall masts, single masts, and the business of climbing up one of those masts was extremely dangerous. And I think there was a bit of drama on The Boat That Rocked where somebody climbed up one of these short, stubby things.
Yeah.
Not really. You know, it was nothing like that. Also, I don't recall there were ever any girls on board. Most people would be surprised to find that.
Well, you mentioned the mast. I worked with an engineer who you, I'm sure, is a name you'll know, who's sadly no longer with us, called Russ Tollefield. And Russ would regale me with tales of having to climb up this mast on many an occasion, you know, and the ship would be rocking around like no business. He'd be up there with a soldering iron. It's just extraordinary stuff.
Oh, yeah. You wouldn't really want to do that unless you really had to do it. And, you know, sometimes it just get the thing back on the air again. You were up because you couldn't go up there with when the transmitter was on. You'd get frazzled. But you know, it was pretty dangerous stuff. So The Boat That Rocked, it seemed a bit tepid.
Yeah. But great times. I mean, as a broadcaster, as a DJ, to have that as your kind of, you know, driving up and down the M1 in a white van equivalent for a musician must have just been awesome.
Yeah, I'm very grateful to have been around at that time and been one of the chosen handful that actually managed to get on board these things. I had no right to be there. I was no better than anybody else on the street that thought they could have a crack at it. I didn't know anything, you know, about it except what I'd heard on the radio. So when I first went on the radio, I imitated everything I'd ever heard. You know, I was copying everything I could hear. It's the only way I could develop a style, which I hope I did eventually, but
yeah.
I think I wasn't the only one that did that. I mean, where else would you get your experience?
Absolutely. You, a very similar career path to me. You're also a musician. You also produced radio station jingles, both of which I did as well. You in 71 joined Radio Luxembourg. Last week on the show, we had David Hamilton, who I guess at the time, those people were your fierce rivals because you really had no competition.
Well, now you see, this is the thing. I joined Radio Luxembourg in 1971, and I was there for very nearly 11 years. And in the first 5 or 6 years, we really had the evenings to ourselves. We were only on in the evenings anyway.
Yeah.
And Radio 1, which would be our direct daytime competitor if we were on during the daytime, in the evening, they weren't really playing a lot of pop music and what have you. So we still had the pop music scene, you know, sewn up for ourselves. And we could go out and do discos and personal appearances and clubs up and down the country and pack them out. It was just extraordinary. Great fun.
What was the setup at Radio Luxembourg? I mean, why Luxembourg?
It's to do with the issuing of licenses, transmitting licenses and frequencies, radio frequencies. And Luxembourg had it, or each country had its own designated frequencies that it could use. Luxembourg had 208 and whatever that is in kilohertz.
Yeah.
And in order to use that efficiently, commercially, they broadcast to other countries. Within itself, Luxembourg isn't a very large place to broadcast to. You know, it's not a big audience for it. So the big audience is out there. So they had several radio stations, RTL,
yeah.
Which it, people might recognise seeing microphones thrust in politicians' faces,
yeah.
Saying RTL. Well, that's Radio Télé Luxembourg, and it's the same company. And they're in France, very big, and in Germany, very big as well. And, of course, we were relatively a smaller part of that operation in the evenings, but we had what we had going for us as far as Radio Luxembourg was concerned and the mother company was, because we were the English service, the service anglais, as they called us, we had the benefit of all that great music, which they'd be playing on the other service, but with the English service, it was the real McCoy. You know, these were the English people, from the musicians that were English, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Elton John, you know, all of this, Queen, you know, all of this stuff came out of Britain, made us, punched way above our weight. It's fantastic.
What was the logistical reason for only broadcasting in the evenings then?
Because they made more money out of the Germans during the day. What would you do?
Love it. Now, as an ex-record plugger, you mentioned the music there. Luxembourg were a very powerful, not only in terms of how many watts it broadcast, but in terms of its influence on music in the United Kingdom was immense, wasn't it?
Yeah, we could break records. It was very prestigious, and if you particularly if you got the power play, you know you get a record played once an hour.
Yeah.
But everybody that wanted to have any kind of presence on radio or to have an influence have just started their recording career. They would be flown over to Luxembourg for interviews during the evening. And had their records or albums played. It would be singles during the evening, and then later on at night, when Kids' Dimensions were Jensen's Dimensions were on, they'd play a lot of the albums. You know, so it went a bit more serious. But we were never short of free dinners.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure.
It was amazing.
Absolutely. And physically, how did it work? I mean, were you all living in a very similar area? I can't imagine it'd be that big a place. So it wasn't like the Big Brother house, that you're all living in the same house and then going to work at your various shift times.
Thankfully, it wasn't like the ships in that respect. No, we had apartments that we lived in, and we had our free time during the day, and we'd probably pop into the Villa Louvigny, which is this building in the middle of a park in the middle of the city of Luxembourg, pop into the English service office to see if there's any news, what we should be thinking about, what's going on. Not an awful lot of program preparation, because it was all formatted. What would happen is the playlist for the evening would get faxed over.
That's great, isn't it? Faxed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when it wasn't faxed before, I mean, when we had a fax machine, this is a great new invention. Before that, I think the programs were set up weeks before and they were flown over in boxes. As sheets of paper. Well, then we had to go into, and don't forget, we didn't initially play our own records. We had an engineer in a room opposite through the glass window.
Yes.
And all the records would be there in a box, like a set of 40 records. That was a top 40 format sort of thing. And then we'd just pull out the records we're going to play for the next 2 hours, turn them upside down, hand them over to the I said they were in the right order, you know. And then I hand them over to the engineer with a copy of the playlist, and I take my copy of the playlist through to the studio. We had a row of buttons. One was a gong, which you tried not to play, because obviously those are the old days of Radio Luxembourg gong. And later on, we didn't use that, but we did have cough buttons and buzzers to wake the engineer up. Wait, come on. And a lot of hand movement. So we had this microphone dangling from the ceiling, which we used to hold very close to our mouths. And interestingly enough, by the way, curiosity, because people inevitably talk about the signal of Radio Luxembourg, how it sounded in the UK, very weird digital, you know, sound, not digital, but very faded in and out.
Yeah, swooshy, swooshy and hissy,
But it was very similar in Luxembourg, oddly enough. it didn't sound any different. But what we were able to do is listen off the studio. Which sounded rather dead because there was no compression in it. It sounded a bit lifeless.
Yeah.
So we managed to get them wired up so that it came out from the compressor side so we could listen to it as a compressed. Sounded like FM. It sounded much better in the studio.
Funny.
But before we did that, we used to listen off air, and with the microphone so close to our headphones, because the signal came and went, sometimes you get this great signal that would come bursting through the headphones and the microphone would pick it up and start whistling and feeding back.
That's great
strange
memories.
You know, these are weird, unexpected things. And of course, it's all part of the treasure trove that is the Luxembourg experience.
Fabulous. And I'm sure you wouldn't have swapped it for anything, Mark.
Not at all.
No. One of the reasons we've got you on today is that you've turned your hand now to writing. You brought your first novel out in April 2015, and you've got another one out now called Frack. So I would imagine that for a DJ, the discipline of sitting down and writing a novel is quite difficult.
I don't recommend it to anyone. except to say, I do recommend it to everyone because it's both pain and pleasure.
Yeah.
And it's something I tried to avoid initially. I had this idea which I thought I could put together as a couple of pages. This is for the first book, but it wasn't going to be a book. I wanted it to be a movie. I wanted to present this idea, which I thought was very unique and original, for a story called Bank, B-A-N-G-K. And it's about taking gold from the Bank of England. And of course, it relied on the idea that actually you think outside the box. You don't try and get the gold. You get them to take some of the gold and put it somewhere else, which is much easier to take. And how do you do that was the trick. And that sold pretty well, I have to say. I did very well. But I didn't want to write that. In fact, I asked a friend of mine, Sean Williamson, whether he fancied writing it, because we'd been using Sean as an actor in some films that we were making. And he said, I'll have a look at it. Well, he didn't. And 18 months passed, and I ended up writing it myself over those 18 months. And I knew I had to bite the bullet and get this down. I couldn't trust myself to finish it. I was really nervous about, you know, the effort that it's going to take to write 360 pages or whatever it is, and not get to the end of it after all that time. I didn't trust myself.
Brilliant.
Set aside whether I thought I had the skill to do it. That's something you have to learn over time, you know, and you go back to the beginning and about 40 drafts later until it's a good book. It all works well from one end to the other.
Yeah.
So I did that. And then the follow-up is the same characters, James Stack and Charlie Hollywood Dawson and Summer Peterson. And they're back in trouble again. And it's great fun. The thing is, these are action adventure stories. They're good. There's humour in it, a bit like The Italian Job in a way.
Yeah.
But it's a little more serious in the follow-up, which picks up where Bank left off. Although Bank does conclude very satisfactorily, there's a little phone call at the end that doesn't get answered, and it gets answered in Frack. And of course, Frack is a very contentious idea, fracking and what have you. Everybody's got an opinion about it. The book doesn't take a side, by the way, what happens is a company called GeoPower gets a license to frack in Derbyshire, and the idea is that they drill down and then they use a directional driller to drill along this shale, and that's as they get to the end of the hole that they drilled, can be up to 5 miles long or deep, as they call it. Then they start fracking, and of course that's the thing that everybody is worried about, or some people are worried about. Now, if the question I ask myself about this whole business of fracking is, how the hell do they know where the drill bit is? Because it's underground. There's no means of knowing where it is. So I brought in a couple of really nice guys. They're drilling consultants. And they said, you can ask us anything, we'll give you information, we will anything you want. And they were true to their word.
Wow.
And I was deluged with information, because I had to filter through all that to actually come to enough info that the reader would say, oh, I get how this works now.
Yeah.
But at the same time, not deluging them with technical stuff, which, you know, just gets in the way of the story.
Yeah.
So it's the real McCoy, but thinned out a little bit so that it's a proper adventure story with
Brilliant.
All the facts in there.
Brilliant.
So my question was, so how do they know? And of course, they have a technique for knowing where the drill bit is, and it's that technique which is the Achilles heel in all this. And what happens is the drill bit gets sabotaged and hijacked by a Russian oligarch who's got gas fields in Russia, in northern Russia, and he finds a way to change the direction of the drill bit, so it's now drilling towards a fault, a geological fault, deep underneath a hill. And he knows that when they start fracking, it will dislodge this fault to the extent that enormous seismic activity will happen, and all fracking will be stopped in the UK. We will then, so all licenses will be, that he knows that that will be the outcome if he manages to get away with this. And guess who will get all the gas contracts? He's already done a deal with the government.
Never trust a Russian oligarch. Never trust them, Mark.
Yeah, so yeah, the old oligarchs was a good fallback, but but that's the point. Is if you take a view whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, but we still need gas. Yeah. So if we may not frack, that may never happen, for instance, but we will still need gas. It's got to be bought from somewhere.
Now, you see, if only you'd actually been the Russian oligarch, you wouldn't need to write novels because you'd be so wealthy. If you come up with that as a plot in real life, everything would be fine.
Well, exactly, because the trick is if they don't know where the drill bit is, you know, before it's hijacked, they still don't know where the drill bit is when it's been hijacked.
Yeah.
It's a subterfuge. So how do they find out that it's been hijacked?
Oh.
And that's the trick in this. It's little bits of detail and little bits of data that come up from underground that start, you know, asking questions and what's going on. So eventually, it's a detective story, really, in that respect. It's a good, you know, big high adventure yarn.
Brilliant. It's called Frack, and you can get that now, as well as the first book, as you mentioned there. I can't let you go without mentioning that in 2 weeks, I think 2 weeks exactly today, will be the 40th anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley. And you were the man who first reported the singer's death in Europe.
Yes, it is.
Is it urban myth or true?
No, it is true, up to a point. I think it's more accurate to say I was the first person to report it in the UK,
right?
Although I was in Luxembourg. What happened was I was on the air, and the German service were on air in a studio, literally on the floor below. And one of the at about 10:30, I think it was, one of their reporters, one of their news guys, came in. He said, "Do you know, Mark, I think we're getting a story in about Elvis. He may have died. We're not sure. We're just waiting. But don't say anything until we get it confirmed." So it was through the German service that it came through. And then finally, at about 10 to 11, he said, "Yes, it's definitely been confirmed. He died. And we don't know the circumstances, but he's certainly dead." So I gave that information out at 10 to 11. That Elvis had in fact died, more at 11, you know.
Yes.
And then dear Tony Prince came along and did a show that followed, and he did a sort of a tribute to Elvis. So it was me that introduced that bit of sad news at 10 to 11 and then read the news at 11 o'clock, giving more detail to the whole thing. So,
incredible. Wow. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, Mark. Really appreciate it. The book is called Frack.
From Amazon. Buy it now. $8.99. You'll love it.
you know what? You should take up radio. I think you've got the right voice for selling stuff. I think you'd make a fortune, Mark. What about those spots, anyway? Have you worked out now what we should do about them?
I've still got them. They've never worked.
Okay. All right, then. Mark Wesley, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill.
All the best. Bye-bye.